almost intuitively, most of us are familiar with this connection that our mental state is reflected in how we can cope with disease. So what we started to do is to break down all this mental state and how all these mental conditions eventually can manifest in changes in physiology.
Hello and welcome to Neural Compass, the Gemini Health podcast. I'm Mark Jacobstein, your host. At Gemini Health, we're using AI and cutting-edge clinical science to radically improve efficacy and access to mental health care. We started Neural Compass to explore everything happening in our field, from psychology and genomics to neuroscience and AI. This podcast is an excuse for me to go deep with some of the world's most interesting thinkers about one of our most essential problems. How do our minds work, and how do we live happy and fulfilled lives in the age of anxiety? We know placebo effects are real. In episode 2 of Neural Compass, Is the Brain Our Most Powerful Medicine? Dr. Asiya Rolls helps unpack how they work. You'll be fascinated by our discussion of her groundbreaking paper, Placebos, Beliefs, and the Brain, the prefrontal cortex's role in healing, the surprising science behind placebo effects, and what it means to want to get better. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. I'm really excited to have with us Dr. Asiya Rolls, who is an Israeli psychoneuroimmunologist, which is quite a mouthful, and international Howard Hughes Medical Institute researcher. She is currently a professor at Tel Aviv University, and before this was a professor at the Rappaport Medical School at the IIT. Dr. Rolls leads a lab that explores how the nervous system affects immune responses and thus physical health. We're really excited to explore what the implications of this are for therapeutic responses and implications even in mental and behavioral health and where the sort of the brain-body intersection goes. She did her PhD at the Technion and the Weizmann Institute and a postdoc here at Stanford, and we're really excited to have her here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you for hosting me.
Yeah, terrific. So I thought maybe we'd start with some of the first work you did. I think you started this perhaps during your postdoc here at Stanford, which was the look at what happens with sleep and sleep continuity and what that means for memory consolidation. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, as we were discussing before we started recording. I have a three-year-old who constantly interrupts my sleep continuity. That's perhaps my excuse for my challenges with memory. So maybe start there with some of the work there. And what you learned. I mean, everybody knows that sleep is good, but one of the things that it seems you took apart was that sleep has duration and intensity and also continuity, and specifically the ability to sort of look at what happens vis-a-vis continuity was really interesting. So maybe I'll ask you to describe the work and we can talk a little bit about the methods and the findings.
Yeah, it's long ago, actually. I think I'm happy to go over it. And I also can say that I think my interest in neuroimmunology actually started already in the PhD. So, but sleep was kind of a way for me to start looking. I when I was on my PhD, I was working on how the immune system controls the brain. And then I knew I was really interested in how the brain will control the immune system, but I had no idea how to approach this question. And I thought that sleep might be a very good way of kind of looking in major changes in brain activity and how they will affect eventually physiology in major aspects. But then we started looking on what was most associated with sleep, and it seemed like it was memory consolidation. But we know that we can sleep for a very long time, like they expected 7 or 8 hours, but then still it doesn't help as much as we expect. And in part is because we wake up a lot. And one of the phenomena that are known for this, for example, sleep apnea, when they have frequent arousals, just breakdown of the sleep, and they have a lot of memory problems. And then you can say, you don't know what you can attribute the problem for. And therefore, what we wanted to do is to break down the whole phenomena and really focus on sleep continuity. So what we did, it was just the beginning of optogenetics at Stanford. And so we suddenly had the tool to break down sleep, which is such a complex phenomenon, right? And we said, okay, so now we can play and just kind of increase the frequency of arousals. And the way we did it is using a system known as orexin system, orexinergic system. These are neurons that are important for stabilizing sleep. And we were just pushing into it, the system, and tapping into it and inducing more arousals. So mice would sleep exactly the same amount of time, but now we will just activate these neurons more frequently, and then it will just fragment their sleep. And it was amazing to see that there was like a cutoff, as if there was a minimal quanta of sleep, of continued sleep that was required for the memory consolidation.
As I recall, it was something on the order of 62% of the evening's sleep needed to be uninterrupted for the memory consolidation to sort of achieve the levels that it achieves in normal sleep. And as a father of young children, I appreciate the challenges of this for humans. Have further studies, I know you were working with mice, have people gone on to sort of study this further in humans?
Yeah, actually, it was interesting. At some point, they even reanalyzed data from patients with sleep apnea. And they saw it was not the severity of the sleep apnea, but it was actually the amount of arousals, like how fragmented the sleep was eventually. So it was even shown in these patients. And I think there are many follow-ups, like many ways in which people try to approach. And I think sleep is going to be a big thing in the next few years, especially with the emergence of AI, that can take this such a complex phenomena and start to see much more details in it.
It does feel like, and I know we probably won't spend too much of the conversation today on sleep specifically, but it does feel like one of the real frontier areas that we don't understand as much as we'd like, and it seems to be implicated in everything. Your own research, I think, had implications, for example, for PTSD folks and memory consolidation and the ability perhaps to break down bad memories and some of the current techniques that they use in PTSD. Maybe if you can just touch on that briefly.
What we were looking there is actually, so what happens in sleep, and this is unique, you can rarely access the original memory. And it's very hard then if you're trying to erase like the original fear response that you have in PTSD, you never access the original memory. You actually access only the suppression. You can create new memories that will suppress the original fear. But what happens during sleep is this is a natural state in which the brain actually gets access to the original memory and reactivates it for remodeling. Like it just becomes labile. And yeah. Then
you have access to these memories that your conscious mind, your waking mind is repressing enough that you don't have the opportunity to access them and thus either break them down, remove sort of the associations.
Exactly. And I think this is the potential, and there are many more studies. What we did was really in the beginning of the field, but I think now we really understand that this is a unique setup also for therapeutic interventions.
It's fascinating. As I was going through your work, actually, one of the studies I noticed was work you done on sleep disruption, impairing hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, which I immediately forwarded to my wife, who happens to work on hematopoietic stem cell gene editing, cell editing therapies. And I said, just make sure that your mice are well rested if you want your engraftment to occur successfully. And she laughed, but I think we'll make sure that actually happens. It's very interesting to think about the implications here in terms of sort of bidirectional causality in mental and behavioral health challenges. I think of things like, you know, we know that anxiety, for example, can drive insomnia. It's interesting to think about things like insomnia, particularly the forms of insomnia that drive sort of frequent wake-ups, leading to things like anxiety and depression. And to your point earlier, it seems like a really rich area for study going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
Maybe moving on from sleep, though, the most of your career since then has been spent on studying brain-regulated immunity. And it's just the results are absolutely fascinating. Rather than me trying to describe some of the papers I've read here, I'd love for you to sort of talk about what you've learned regarding brain-regulated immunity, what the implications are might be for various diseases where the immune system, of course, is critical, including not just cancer, but autoimmune disease, et cetera.
Well, I think it's almost intuitively, most of us are familiar with this connection that our mental state is reflected in how we can cope with disease. Epidemiology is full with evidence for a connection between stress, mental state, and emergence of disease. And we have all this evidence about placebo as a minor pharmacological but this is crazy, right? You can give someone a sugar pill and they will get better. And you say, how did it happen? Eventually, the brain somehow initiated a cascade of events that ended up with improved physiological state. And there are many caveats to the, like, how long the effect of placebo can go and many other, and it doesn't affect everyone, like, not everyone will respond to placebo. But then you ask yourself, so, but what happens? How does the brain change something in the body? Eventually, we know that there is strong response in placebo for in allergies, in many different gut conditions. So it does raise the question, what does the brain do? So what we started to do is to break down all this mental state and how all these mental conditions eventually can manifest in changes in physiology. And we moved, I think we focused on the immune system because it's involved in everything. And right. This was kind of easy place for us to begin because of my training. But I think it applies to almost every aspect. It can be relevant also for glucose metabolism. It can be relevant for almost every aspect of physiology. Because I think the underlying basis of all of these phenomena is that the mental state should be synchronized with the body. Eventually, the brain is there to allow the body to exist in a certain environment, in changing environments.
So the brain has mechanisms for communicating with all the organ systems, including the immune system, and driving change, which is just fascinating. And to your point earlier, it is something we intuitively understand. Although it's also, and we'll get into this when we talk about your findings in oncology, it's the sort of thing that people both believe and understand, but don't, but I think there's a sense of a little bit of like, oh, that's like, it almost feels like that can't really be true, that having a positive attitude is going to impact, for example, what happens with tumor growth. Feels a little bit like, you know, aromatherapy or something where like, does that really work? What's the evidence there? And we'll talk a little bit about the evidence. So speaking of the evidence, one of the things that I found most fascinating about your work was some of the methods that you used to discover some of the things and sort of the combination of the use of DREDS and CyTOF, mass cytometry, and sort of emerging tools have allowed you to tease out some of the phenomena that you describe. Can you talk a little bit about that at the risk of being going sort of deep on kind of a nerdy methods topic? I actually think it's really important because it sort of seems to underpin a lot of the work.
So the idea was that we wanted to establish causality, and exactly what you mentioned. It almost sounds like voodoo or something. How does it really happen? So I wanted to understand mechanisms through causality. So what we did, we wanted to activate certain brain areas. Brain areas, for example, in placebo, you have activation of the brain's reward system because you have this anticipation and positive expectations, right? So we know that when during placebo, there's activation of their brain's reward system. So what we said, okay, now let's activate the reward system and see what happens causally to the immune system. So we need the tools to activate directly the reward system or whichever neurons that we want to manipulate. And this is what we can do now with optogenetics, with DREDS, which are basically methods in which you express in your target neurons a receptor that will respond to an otherwise innate agent. So you can activate, once you inject this agent, it will activate only the target neurons. And in order to target these neurons, you combine genetics. So you have transgenic mice, and so you actually target specific promoters. So only, for example, dopaminergic neurons, because they have dopaminergic promoter, will now express this receptor that you want to
control. I was curious about just how precise you could be with DREDS and whether this was sort of like location-based and you're not picking out individual neurons. But the idea is that neurons that have some sort of specific genetic expression can be targeted through these vectors. And then in effect, now they've got an on-off switch that exactly. You can then, yeah, which is just fascinating. And so that allows you to target something as sort of precise as, say, the reward center of the brain, but not something like, you know, these 17 neurons specifically.
Well, not what we're doing now, for example. What we can do now is take from the reward system from the ventral tegmental area, and we target it specifically by stereotactic injection. So we know also spatially which area we're targeting, but we can be even more specific and target Only neurons that project to a certain site, for example, to the nucleus accumbens, to the amygdala, to the prefrontal. And this we're doing by expressing two parts of the information. So one neuron in the VTI will express part of the information, and the other neuron in the nucleus accumbens will express the other part. And only the neurons that have both will now express the receptor that we want, this on and off switch. So we can get all the way to the level of specificity of networks. Amazing. And then we can compare.
And so maybe describe what you found here, and you know, when you were experimenting with the brain reward system and essentially artificially stimulating it.
So what we found is that by activating the brain's reward system, we could boost immunity. And boosting immunity was in different contexts. So we could do it in the context of bacterial infection, and we see that it actually boosted both the innate response and also then the adaptive response, like the vaccination kind of response to the same initial trigger. We also saw it when we injected mice with tumors, and we did models of Lewis Lung carcinoma or B16 like melanomas. And we could see that just by activating the brain's reward system, we could reduce the size of the tumor almost by half. And it's without any other intervention. So only by activating the brain, we could get this kind of effect. And more recently, we even showed it with a heart attack model of mice, in which we actually created the heart attack. And by activating the reward system, it allowed the heart to recover much more effectively.
It's absolutely amazing finding. One of the things that's really interesting, since we put Jiminy Health together a year and a half ago, one of the things I've been saying to anyone who will listen when we talk about sort of the importance of mental and behavioral health is that things like anxiety and depression, for example, I describe them as the ultimate comorbidity. And there's lots of studies, health economic studies, that demonstrate that, for example, folks who have struggled with anxiety or depression, who are undertreated or untreated, end up being more expensive in the health system beyond just their mental and behavioral issues, but they end up, their diabetes is worse, their heart disease is worse, et cetera. I've always assumed that was actually largely a function of behavior, that because you were anxious or because you were depressed, you manifested other behaviors that had sort of poor downstream implications. If you're anxious or depressed, maybe you're not monitoring your glucose as closely as you should be, or you're not getting out and exercising, and that does poor things for your heart disease. And there's probably some truth to that. I haven't seen the data, but I guess that there is. But this is really interesting because it seems like there's a much tighter loop here, which is that your immune system is implicated. And you know, the immune system, for those who haven't studied, is truly incredible. It's also implicated in all health and disease, right? It touches everything from infection to what's happening with cancer and sort of everything in between. So I'm really curious, as your findings are more well known, what the implications will be even for like the health systems and the way they think about mental and behavioral health and the downstream implications for all of these things. Now, I've sort of taken something which is the stimulation of the reward system and jumped ahead to like overall mental health, which is maybe a leap here. I'm curious, have you found other parts of the brain, other CNS systems that have implications in the immune system, sort of beyond the reward center?
So we started with the reward system, but I think since then we and others have found connections to many brain areas, and it's became more and more systematic. I can say the original works on all of these connections were Kevin Tracy's work showing that the vagus nerve it can suppress immune activity. It was more in the peripheral level, but eventually there is control of the vagus nerve by many different brain areas that can send instructions to this network. And studies have shown connections between amygdala and how it can regulate responses of B cells and many others, actually. More brainstem areas that seem to be responding to inflammation and then kind of initiating a corrective response. Some evidence also come from many hypothalamic areas. So maybe I will actually conceptualize it. I think we're talking about several different types of in which the brain can regulate immunity or kind of make this connection. One, we can talk about the basic need to restore homeostasis. So you get an inflammation, and then the structures responsible for homeostasis will initiate a corrective response. And then you can expect a corrective response at the level of the immune system or metabolism. They will synchronize everything. It can be blood flow. All of that can be synchronized by these basic structures that are responsible for homeostasis. You can also talk about other things when the brain has a unique advantage, and this is anticipation. When the brain can predict that something is coming. And this can be, for example, anticipating that the drug is going to be effective for you, right? Then, of course, you initiate a certain cascade. I think originally it started, what are natural rewards? The reward system is involved, of course. It wasn't developed for placebo. It's response to natural rewards, which are feeding and mating. And if you think about that, in both cases, you are exposed to pathogens, either by interacting with someone or by eating them. So anticipating the fact that you are going, the connection between the two gives you a huge evolutionary advantage. If you prime the immune system in anticipating an interaction or eating, then you can get an advantage. So you can get boosting. The problem, of course, comes with these activations being unregulated. Right. For example, I think, and actually more recently, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, so stop me here, but I think the brain even stores, and we showed it recently, that the brain actually stores representations of past inflammatory reactions and can replay them as a trigger. And I think this is very much relevant to many conditions like Crohn's and I think it's almost like PTSD of the body.
It's a fascinating idea because I was going to ask you to sort of push on what the implications here are for autoimmunity and maybe just for some of the listeners who haven't spent too much time thinking about the immune system. And I just came to it sort of 4 or 5 years ago, naive, which is a wonderful way to come to it because it allows for sort of simple metaphors. I think the crude understanding most people have is like, oh, you're more immunity good, right? Like, good. Well, let's go kill the bacteria, the viruses, or the tumor cells that are growing in your body. The problem is, of course, dialing up your immune system means it's inflammation and the attacking of cells is harmful unless those are cells that you want to kill. And the immune system is precise, but it's not that precise. And so too much immunity is just as harmful as not enough immunity. And too much immunity manifests in what are called autoimmune disorders, which can be devastating. Crohn's being an example, others like lupus, and for that matter, probably long COVID, et cetera. My sense is that we're all living with a variety of autoimmune disorders at any time. It's sort of part of the human condition. The immune system does what it does. It kills the diseases, fortunately. Also, it lingers in ways that are not so good. And so you want to dial up the immune system when you're fighting cancer. That's what immunotherapies do, for example. You often want to dial down the immune system. And if you're somebody who struggles with Crohn's or IBS or lupus or what have you, the whole point is that your immune system is killing you, or if not killing you, at least attacking you in ways that are really harmful. So it's a fascinating notion that you have, in effect, a neural representation of an immune response, and that something like Crohn's is, in effect, the PTSD of the immune system. How are they demonstrating that, or is that still speculation?
No, we actually showed it. It was a paper that we published, I think, 21. And we showed what we could do is we used mice in which we can, these are transgenic mice that allow us to capture neurons that were active at a given time point. So we created a mouse model of Crohn's, meaning a gut inflammation, and captured the neurons that were active at the same time point. These are the neurons in the insular cortex. And then once after mice recovered completely, because when we captured them, we could also get control over these neurons. After mice recovered completely, we just reactivated the neuronal ensembles that were active during the original inflammation. And by doing so, we recreated the inflammation, suggesting that the brain, it's actually showed that the brain can create disease. Right. And now Now it opens a whole array of potential implications, as you were talking,
I'm,
right?
I'm thinking about the therapeutic implications here and whether there are therapies that, it's interesting because, of course, there's you can imagine pharmacological therapies that would be dialing up or dialing back the sort of neuronal response that then causes this immune mm-hmm. cascade. But it also makes me think about things like less invasive things that are, I mean, literally like, imagine meditation that helps control your Crohn's. Are people pushing in that therapeutic direction?
Yeah, I think it's becoming an active field of research. You can do neurofeedback that is guided based on signals. There are many ways in which eventually, once you know where you're looking and what is the signature you're looking for in the brain, then you can start play with that. I can imagine games or virtual reality, because eventually the brain is supposed to respond to signals from the world, right? So if you combine them in the right way, you can basically control these areas in many different ways. Of course, the challenge is to do it right. And also, I think maybe if we're talking about mental disease, many mental conditions are also accompanied by physiological symptoms, as you said before. And maybe what we are talking about here is that many psychosomatic disorders, when people have some kind of triggered condition, pain for different reasons, and all different conversion conditions, what used to be called hysteria, and it just gets different manifestations, they have a physiological basis. Like in the end, if you have a paralysis, there is something happened, right? If you have a strong pain, something happened. It can wherever it happened, but we can understand also the physiology. And we know that many, many mental conditions are also accompanied by abdominal pain or pain in the gut. So they somehow connected and we don't even know what causal there. What is the egg and what is the chicken?
The gut-brain axis is another area that I just find absolutely fascinating and sort of understudied, and is like serotonin. Most of your serotonin is produced in the gut, and I will say my own personal struggles with anxiety earlier in my life. One of the most important things that I did was discover that I was lactose intolerant, which sounds like sort of California mumbo jumbo. Oh, I stopped drinking milk, and then I felt less anxious and less depressed. And it just sounds like such nonsense. But at least for me personally, I realized that that's anecdata. It turned out to be actually really important, both because of how I felt, but also because lactose intolerance was driving insomnia. Rumbly gut, hard to sleep, insomnia implicated in all these other things based on some of your earlier work. And one of the things that I think is so fascinating about the kind of work that you're doing and colleagues as well is sort of the bidirectionality of all this, that it's not just, of course, that what's happening in the CNS is driving interesting things downstream in the immune system, but also it's sort of, it's bidirectional and not just from the immune system, but as you mentioned, from the gut and other organ systems ultimately affecting the brain and hence your mental health. Yeah.
Absolutely. There's a really strong correlation, by the way, between psoriasis and skin conditions and mental conditions.
Again, not surprising, I guess, given what we're hearing in terms of psoriasis it's an autoimmune disorder. Yes. Where your immune system is ultimately attacking certain epithelial cells that it shouldn't be. And sounds like your brain is dialing up your immune system in ways that are unhealthy. Are there any digital therapeutics that have sort of been taking on this challenge? I'm reminded. So I happen to be involved with a company called Luminopia that has a treatment for amblyopia, sometimes commonly known as wandering eye, which people think of as a disease of the eye, but it's not. It's a disease of the brain. Ultimately the implications for vision are much more serious than people realize. And historically, the treatment was patching. Doesn't work very well. What the founders of this company figured out is in retraining the brain, they could change what happened. They do this via a VR headset that forces your eye to do certain things. And they meaningfully, like very, very meaningfully, impact the ability for children to see out of the eye that's affected by the amblyopia. So that's a good example of a now FDA-approved digital therapeutic actually impacting your brain and then sort of the downstream symptoms. Are people pursuing similar things here with some of the findings that you and your lab have found?
I think there are several things that are coming together, and not only, basically, actually, not from our lab directly. We are doing some research, actually clinical research. But in terms of companies, I think there are several companies that are now trying to modulate the brain as a way to treat different conditions. We are involved with a specific, but it's not, I think there are many ways in which you can approach it. The key is really, like you described, I think this lactose intolerance is a wonderful example, because then you have a way of aberrant activation of the immune system in the gut. You have a signal that goes to the brain that constantly disrupts, sends some kind of information to the network. And this changes in general, all this information, once you understand the connection, you can start breaking it down. And I think if you look on many of these conditions, you can see specific activity in the brain that is unique to different conditions. And we know it for many years now. And the question is, will we be able to modulate it? So it's, some of the interventions that we know already exist are related to neurofeedback, mainly EEG-mediated neurofeedback. But I'm actually sure that there are many companies that are doing some kind of digital intervention or digital manipulations to do that.
Yeah, it's just fascinating. It seems as you understand more and more sort of causal relationships between things that are happening in the brain and then the downstream implications in other organ systems that impact, that become disease, there's a variety of different interventions you can imagine. The challenge is some are much more invasive than others. So the easiest and lightest is a digital intervention where I look at something or I learn to breathe in a certain way, or I learn a behavioral technique. And fortunately, that is enough to melt my tumors or improve my heart disease or something along. That's the dream.
That's a very challenging dream, right? Because the difference between individuals is insane. And I think what we are still really lacking, and I think there is a gap that clearly is going to be filled, but right now there is a huge gap between what we start to understand, but we don't know how to really activate these brain areas in individuals. It almost becomes an art of how you can manipulate, whether one can succeed or not, whether the feedback that we get from all the EEG information, how accurate it is. Does it reflect what we think it reflects? In most cases, it doesn't. So I think there is still a knowledge gap that once we fill it in with real data, and I think the AI is going to be a huge transformation for us, then we can start really design things and not just use, I think most of what's happening right now is using a black box, not only in the computational level, but also looking at the physiology as a black box. And I think this is the black box that we can open. It's not so hard to open it. It's hard, of course, but it's not really confounded.
We now have the techniques, and it sounds like you mentioned ML. It does feel like as we start to talk about extremely complex systems, ML will play a really important role in figuring out the through line and the mechanism of action for some of these things. It probably would have been just untenable for a human researcher acting alone to pull apart before sort of modern ML techniques. It's really interesting. I think your point about like every individual is going to be different, and we're also, precision is going to matter a lot here, which is why the dream of like the easy digital therapeutic is probably mostly a dream for most conditions. And there's interesting implications here too, that in some ways sort of the diagnostic will tie into the therapeutic, and meaning that like you're struggling with IBD, it's been a problem your whole life, the neural pathway, the cerebral PTSD that we kind of want to modulate to help get rid of your IBD or help is slightly different than for somebody else. We're going to have to understand yours in order to treat yours. And so the diagnostic will sort of bleed into the therapeutic, which I guess is true for all of what has happened with sort of precision medicine. But of course, makes it more difficult and expensive and complex as we think about treatment. It's easier when you have like very simple nail, very simple hammer, like bacteria bad, penicillin good, pretty much true for everyone on earth. And that's a great start, but it doesn't help for some of these more complex interactions.
Yeah, I think what is going to happen, and you're right, that of course, bacteria is bad, penicillin is good. It's one range of disease that we can, it's great that we have them. But I think what is going to happen is that eventually we're going to look at psychiatry very differently. Right now we are almost, because there are ways in which we look on behaviors that are, there are kind of salient signals. Okay, this is depression, but depression can come from so many different reasons. And once you understand what is the source of the depression, you can treat it. One person, the depression is actually a manifestation of an inflammation. It might be almost an extreme of sickness behavior, because when we are sick with bacteria, we are depressed, right? And there is a mechanism that can explain it. Actually, there are immune receptors in the brain neurons that are involved in that. But depression that comes from a different source is a completely different type, even though behaviorally they manifest with salient symptoms. I think the deep point is really going to be, and then maybe it's going to be even much more cost effective, because you're not going to treat a patient with the wrong thing for a very long time and actually worsen the symptoms.
Yeah. Well, I love this vision. I mean, it makes me think about, so it would explain, for example, why historically things like SSRIs are only so effective. I think the thing is actually they're quite effective for some people and not effective at all for others. And it reminds me a little bit of oncology 50 years ago, when what we had was chemo, and right. And there's always been surgery. That's of course, like, you can cut it out, fantastic. But chemo was a very, very, very coarse tool, still is. Mm-hmm. And over time we figured out that there's not like cancer. There are hundreds of very, very specific cancers with very specific drivers. And now we have very, very specific treatments for some of them. Not many of them we do not, unfortunately, but for some of them we have very specific treatments. And the responses from patients are extraordinary. Tumors literally melting away and very few adverse events and et cetera. It'd be amazing if we could push towards that with mental and behavioral health. Because to your point, we literally don't even have language for it. You're depressed or you're anxious. There's no analog to you have EGFR-driven non-small cell lung cancer with a C797S like resistance mechanism, right? I've never heard a psychiatrist or psychologist talk that way. You're depressed or you're anxious.
But I think it's coming. Even in our lab, we have data now that we look at this and we can make distinctions. So I'm sure that it's being done in many, from many different angles. I think psychiatry is going to go through a huge change. And not only psychiatry, also the other physiological symptoms. I think we are going to find many, there's going to be a lot of reuse of drugs. So in the end, once we understand the mechanisms, we'll be able to treat immune conditions with drugs that were originally designed for neuro, and the opposite. And there is a lot is coming.
It's so exciting. And actually, to your last point, of course, in some ways, the best part about that is if those drugs are already approved, then the reuse of them is much simpler, much cheaper. Safety profile has already been established, and you can start helping patients immediately rather than 7, 8, 10 years from now after running your, you know, extensive $100 million RCT that takes a long time. So incredibly exciting future here. So, Asya, I really appreciate both the work you're doing and the conversation today. It's absolutely fascinating. I have sort of one final question for you here as we come up on time, which is something I try to ask everybody who comes on the podcast. We look at mental behavioral health. We look at AI. We're looking at sort of all the implications of orthogonal technologies, et cetera. Do you have a thing that you are reading or listening to, et cetera, that you find particularly fascinating for folks? A book you'd recommend, a podcast, a blog you read regularly that maybe slightly off the beaten path that you think is really well done, and for people who are interested in some of the things we just discussed would be really great to consume?
Actually, I'm these days I'm mostly interested in politics. So it's but from a different angle. And what I find especially interesting is how perspective changes all the way we look on politics or different social conditions, and how you can switch this state, how the brain, and once you acquire a different perspective, you change everything, how everything integrates into it. And I think the same will apply also to physiology. If in a way we can start looking on this framework or of different like programs. And most of the literature I'm really interested in these days is actually related to these mental states and transitions in society, which I think is very much relevant also.
Certainly relevant both in Israel and in the U.S. these days, and all over the world, unfortunately. Fascinating. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for the conversation today. Really enjoyed this and look forward to following your lab and seeing what else you're discovering.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking to you today.
Thanks for listening to Neural Compass, the Jiminy podcast. If today's conversation sparked something for you, follow us at Instagram, YouTube, or LinkedIn, or explore more at jiminyhealth.com. At Jiminy, we're building the future of mental health care with effective, safe, AI-enabled continuous care. See you next time.